You are listening to Fika with Vicky on United Public Radio, 107.7 and 105.3 from New Orleans.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fika. Our returning guest today is Julia Brennan. Julia is the author of the Jacobite Chronicles and Stories series. This series brings us through the years leading up to and during the Jacobite uprising of 1745. Julia's writing is fluid and embracing, gently pulling you into the story and leaving you wanting more. And with 6 chronicles and 5 stories, you'll be satisfied for some time. But don't take my word for it. Diana Gabaldon says this about Julia's writing in Mask of Duplicity: great accuracy and detailed research with a full-blooded, gripping story running and sometimes leaping from page to page. Excellent read, and even better, the beginning of a series. And that was what Julia's cat thinks of her writing. And this bold indie author has now made Diana's methylone list. I say bold because Julia does not wait in the shadows trying to find a publisher. No, she's out there proving that being an indie writer is a choice, not a default. And I love that. Thank you for Alex McGregor. I mean, for the history and intrigue, Julia. And welcome to Fika.
Thank you. Sorry, you just want Alex McGregor, don't you?
No. He's young. They're all young now. you have to write. I know you're starting a new series, but then you have to write a series about when Alex McGregor is in his later years.
Yeah, a lot of people are pushing me for that. And at the moment, I'm resisting because I don't want them tottering into, old age and doing nothing except, you know, eating porridge and looking out the window. I don't want that. And there's no huge historical event in Britain that went on after that period within his lifetime, really. So, you know, I might at some point write something else regarding them, but not right now, no.
And no. Julia is not saying that because you're old in this day, you would be tottering about only eating oatmeal. But in 1745, few people lived to older age, and there wasn't much to do by totter about.
It wasn't interesting, you know. I mean, if you look at the average person's day, that sounds great. You know, it might be interesting to you. But if I write a book and my character, I mean, does what I've done today, though, they go, you know, they get up and have breakfast and then they go out and they, you know, plant some stuff in the garden and then they come in and they make a sandwich. Nobody wants to read that. You want to read about writing stuff.
Well, so, they might if it had Alex McGregor in it. Okay, getting off of Alex, I just... Brian says, hi, Julia. Does your handsome cat act as a co-author or editor?
He acts as an impromptu editor by wandering across my keyboard on my computer while I'm in the middle of writing.
does he make you feel too bad if you, like, say, shush, leave my computer alone?
Yeah, he doesn't actually like me writing because I go upstairs and I sit upstairs. I've got a room upstairs that I sit at with all my books around me and papers and stuff. And he doesn't like that. He cries because he loves sitting on my knee, and he's getting older now and he's getting more sedentary. And he just wants to sit on my knee all the time. But he won't sit on my knee at the computer. He has to sit on the actual keyboard, so he can't. So he's not a fan of me writing my books.
To see your cat holding a sign outside a bookstore saying, don't buy these books.
Yeah, well, I've told him that if nobody buys the books, then he doesn't get fed, but he doesn't seem to be
it's food or cuddles, kitty. So in the opening, I said that you had been put on Diana Gabaldon's methadone list. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is, and has it affected you as a writer?
Right. Yeah. I mean, as far as I know, a methadone list was a list that she started when people had read her books and were waiting for the next one, and they were pestering her about, you know, what can I read while I'm waiting for you to come out with the next Outlander book? Because it obviously takes her a long time to write them, because they're so huge for one thing, and now she's got so many other things going on, the TV series. So she decided to come up with this list, and she called it the methadone list because it was for people who were withdrawing from the latest Outlander book. It's on her website. There are actually very few books on there. So she only puts authors or books up there that she really, really likes, not just ones that she says, oh, it's okay, which makes it a huge thing because she's one of the best-selling authors in the world. Mm-hmm. She was saying she was going to do it for a while for me, but she now has. And, it's made a big difference because it's given me a few things. First of all, it's given me massive visibility because she's got over 1 million followers on Facebook alone that she posted this on. And it's also, as an independent author, as a self-published author, given me a lot of kudos. I mean, it's given me credibility because it shouldn't need that, but it does, you know, that this massive author.
Just in case you don't know, Diana is the author of the Outlander series.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, the Outlander series.
No, I was just thinking that may not. So she made Jamie Fraser. So
and so it's a huge thing. It's a bit like, you know, writing a horror book as an independent author and then having Stephen King say, "Well, this is great, you know, I'm gonna stick it on my website as a great book." So it's done that. And on a smaller level, the other thing it's done is the people who said that I was plagiarizing Diana because I was writing about the same time period. No, I'm not, because she would not be recommending a book that plagiarized her.
Yeah, no. People think that there's only one person that can write about a certain... Well, we talked about this before. You know, haters be haters. Yeah. You can't please them. But there are definitely differences between these books. And one of them is that it is pure... It is not historic fantasy, as Outlander is. It's historic fiction. So there are no magic stones or whatever. It's just what's happening in the day.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
So you can't get out of there just making sandwiches for lunch because there's nowhere they can travel to. You can't just say, and then they were in Vegas, right?
Yeah, sometimes I think it'd be great if they could, because I'll write myself into a trap and then think, oh, God, now what, you know.
Yeah, but you know, that's what makes dedicated writing, not to be able to just say poof and we're out of there. Brian has suggested that maybe a heated nest next to the computer, like a towel or something, would help with the cat.
I did try that, and when he was younger, he would sleep. I had a blanket folded up next to me on the and he used to go on it, and then he suddenly decided, as cats do, that no, he wasn't doing that anymore. So
he's just a crotchety old man at this point.
He's a really soppy old man, actually. He's very sweet. But yeah, he's getting a bit like, I'm the most important person in the world, you have to.
So when it comes, what we're talking about, that it's not the same as the Outlander series, that you, can you tell us, I know we did this last time, but for anyone who didn't hear us, this last time, a little bit about the Jacobite Chronicles, and then
it's the Jacobite Chronicles themselves, the main series, is 6 books, which deals with in historical time from the build up to the last Jacobite rising, when Bonnie Prince Charlie came over and tried to take the throne back for his father, who would have been James III if he'd succeeded. And it deals with the build-up to that, the actual rising itself, and then the aftermath, what happened after the Battle of Culloden. So it runs from about 1741 to 1748 in terms of history. And it deals with the MacGregor clan, or part of the MacGregor clan that lived near Loch Lomond, with a special reference to Alex MacGregor, who's the main one of the main characters, and a woman called Beth Cunningham, who's actually English. So it's sort of their love story that runs through all the books, but the history is very, very prominent in it.
Well, that's, well, first of all, I want to say that's one of the big differences is the portrayal of Prince Charles between Outlander and your book. They're completely different. If people are looking for differences, the way that you look at them. And second of all, that reminds me, when you think about Culloden, if I said that properly, that you introduced me this morning to a singer that I didn't know about before.
Oh, right.
Karen Matheson. And you know, I love that kind of music. And you had sent it to me to get in the mood. I put it on Facebook. You sent it to me to get into the mood because this was the song that inspired you when you were writing the battle scenes of Culloden. It was written by a widow way back when, that had lost her husband in that battle. And it is beautiful. I'm not going to try to pronounce the name. Are you?
Maroon Gaelog. It means I think, as far as I remember, it's My Fair Young Love.
And it's just a beautiful song. So there again, and she sings that on your, Alex's first story when you talk about his beginnings.
She doesn't sing that. No, she doesn't sing that.
Okay. She sings.
In the book, without any spoilers, of Alex as a child, the mother sings a lullaby, which was a real lullaby from the 16th century about the MacGregors. It was a MacGregor lullaby. And she sings it in the book. And Karen Matheson sings it in the audiobook. And there's no recording of it anywhere. It's only in the audiobook. She sang it for the audiobook. And it's beautiful. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful.
She has a beautiful voice. I am now a fan. Like, thank you. Did you just ask her to sing for the book, or how did that come about? You have things happening, Julia. Like the whole Diana thing.
Yeah. So, well, originally what happened was that she posted something about the album that song Maroon Gaelog is from. It's called Songs of the 45, Glenfinnan's Songs of the 45. And she posted something on Twitter about it. And I just put underneath a comment saying, oh, I played that album, not just the song, but the whole album. It helped me to be inspired to write about the Battle of Culloden. And she came back to me and said, oh, I don't know anything about this. What is it? So we ended up then going on to private messaging on Twitter. And I told her, you know, that I wrote these series and blah, blah, blah. And she said, oh, I'd be really interested in reading that. So I sent her one of the books and we sort of kept in touch, you know, because she's really nice. She's lovely. And so when I did the audio books, there's obviously this Gaelic in there. And my two narrators are not Gaelic speakers. So I've got a native Gaelic speaker who does a tape for them. An audio file.
That's fine. I think we're all, this audience, I think we'll get tape.
Good. Did a tape for them. It does a tape for them of the pronunciation of all the Gaelic words in my book. Well, in this particular one, I already had poor Will Watt, who's a brilliant narrator, my male narrator, having to do a passage from Homer in Gaelic. And then the song, I thought, oh God. So I messaged Mary Wells, who does the female, and said, do you sing? Are you a singer? She said, well, yeah, I can sing. And then I sat back and I thought, I can't get her to sing a Gaelic. It's just nasty, you know? I thought, it's horrible. Like, it's, not only have you got to sing it, but it's in a foreign language that you don't know, you know? So I thought, oh, I wonder. And I thought, well, what the hell, you know, you do, if you don't ask, you don't get, do you? So I messaged her and messaged Karen Matheson and said, oh, you know, there's a lullaby in my next audio book, you know. I'd love you to sing it if you'd be interested. And she came back and said, I said, it's a McGregor lullaby. It's quite bloody and brutal, but it's a McGregor lullaby from the 1600s. She said, oh, that's interesting. And so I sent her over the lyrics and the tune separately. And she agreed to do it. She thought it was fascinating and she agreed to do it. And it's absolutely, and I was made up because I'm a big fan of Kat McCayley anyway. So I had my little fan moment, you know. But yeah, she did it for me. And it's fabulous. It's lovely. It's in a really evocative scene in the book as well. So it's just beautiful.
Just ask politely, build up relationships. You never know how they're going to help. And so you don't have magic in your books. You just have it in real life.
No, I'm just, I mean, you know, sometimes people are not interested. They just say no.
And you don't get
it. And that's fine. You know, it's not a problem because a lot of these people are really, really busy. You know, and they get, and if you look at somebody like Diana Gabaldon, who's really, really famous, she must get loads and loads and loads of people
really asking. And well, that's just the thing. I mean, it's even doing the show. I ask people, I never hear back. You know, and that's just the way it is. I don't hate them. I still like their books or whatever, but I know people are busy and there are good times and there are bad times to get in touch with them. Author Susan Marcus said, I read The Mask of Duplicity and was struck at how the greed, violence, and duplicity in the story persists in our own time. And that's the thing, right?
Yeah, because that's one of the things I've always loved about historical fiction, reading it as well as writing it, is that, you know, things change, technology changes, standards of living change, general viewpoints and opinions change, but the basic human emotions don't, ever. You know, we're no different in that respect to, you know, centuries ago. People were still making friends, making enemies, getting married, or, you know, forming liaisons, having children, wanting this and that or whatever, you know, that's the same. It's just what you actually want or what is acceptable and not acceptable as a culture changes.
No, this is true.
People in the history is you can relate to those emotions because people still feel them now, you know.
And, you know, there's still the big guy and the little guy and someone who's fighting for equality like Alex McGregor. And no, I'm not. I just can't help it. See, I can't even think anymore. Okay. And even traveling, like people don't always think about how much people traveled back then, but they traveled a lot. They just took longer.
They did actually. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things about doing family history. When I did my family history, it's one of the great misconceptions that you told about is that, you know, people lived in the same village forever. And yeah, some people did. I mean, I've got one branch of my family who lived in the same village for 300 years. But for the most part, no, they travelled. They wouldn't travel like we. I mean, they wouldn't travel 50 miles to go and, you know, have pizza or something. But because they couldn't. But the very poor people, if they travelled, they would travel through necessity. But they did travel and they moved to different places and they did things. And the rich people traveled a lot more, although it was incredibly, by our standards, it was horrendous.
Yeah, no. It wasn't, you know, a five star inn at that time would not equate a five star inn at this time. So you still had to be somewhat brave for cushy traveling at that point in time. But there is the adventurous and you want to go. And what's interesting about that is it's the aristocrats that put up with that discomfort because they were the only ones that could travel, like, you know, unless you were in the Navy or whatever. So they would sleep out or do whatever they had to do. I can't get into too many details because, you know, if you want to find out, go to your nearest book provider. And find a copy. But no, it is true. What we want, love, security, you know, a hot meal, parents that care, they're always the same.
Yeah.
no matter what.
Absolutely. So,
okay. So, I am so bad at pronouncing things. I'm going to say Noreen Sheehan, and thank you for tuning in. Hi, Vicky. Can you ask, how did Julie get so interested in this part of Scottish history in the first place?
Right. Okay. This part of it. I think I talked about this in the last interview, but that I was basically doing my family history. And I've got one branch of my family, who are the Gordons, Gordon Highlanders, who they all emigrated to Ireland at some point. And because of that, I've sort of lost them, because they came back to Scotland again in the 1820s and 30s. Before that, I haven't been able to find much out about them because of the burning of the Dublin Records Office in, I think it was 1921, 22. So I was trying to find out why my Catholic Gordon Highland ancestors might have gone across to Ireland, because Ireland was not a particularly great place to go and live for prosperity if you were a Catholic, and a poor Catholic as well. So I thought there must have been a reason why they left. So I started looking into history for reasons why they might have left, allowing for the fact that my Scots-Irish family are all very, very Republican-minded, independence-minded. And so I started reading about the 18th century, because I realised they would have had to go at the latest in the 18th century. And as I was reading about it, I found the most incredibly fascinating, whole century is fascinating. But when I got to stuff like the Battle of Culloden and so on, I remembered that years before, when I was travelling, I was wandering around the battlefield, not knowing what it was, because it was in the evening and it was raining and the visitor centre was shut. And it wasn't as well laid out as it is now. And I started getting really depressed. I had a really black, depressed dink at the battlefield. And I didn't know why. And so when I started doing the family history and got to the Battle of Culloden, I realised that this was that place I'd visited. And it just inspired me to start thinking a bit more about it. And that's why I got interested in that period. But the continuing interest in it is because it's so fascinating.
It is. And it pivoted a lot of things, like a lot of other politics. Like, there was just a lot involved in the politics and everything at that time. That continued.
Yeah. Yeah,
it continues to this day. I don't want to get into politics, but
no, but the whole political system we've got of party politics, was established in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, they didn't have it really, and it's amazing. It's amazing. There's so many things. I mean, things beyond the period I write about, the Enlightenment. You know, I mean, there was so much going on in that period. It was just insane.
People are moving forward very slowly. Some cases, but they just keep on trying one way or the other. So when you talk about, you know, being see, I just got stuck and I've been thinking, I don't know how much we can talk about Anthony, because that is going to open up a huge thing that happened in the Chronicles. Before, I thought, okay, you can just read this, you know, but it, because Anthony doesn't, Anthony, yeah, I don't think we can. So just know.
Anthony's one of the main characters in the book. He's one of the main characters. You can say that, and you can say he's like most of the other people.
Yes, yes. So we can't particularly just discuss that book openly about the details. I don't think.
You talk about Anthony's story now.
Yeah, because if we discuss Anthony's story, the book, it's going to sort of out Anthony in the Chronicles before we're ready for that to happen. That
didn't
really happen till the next book, did it?
Yeah, it was The Mask Revealed where you
So I should have thought about that before. I don't know why that didn't hit me. I'm just here. Oh, yes. So we'll talk about other things. For example, Rob Roy. I was just discussing him that that was supposed to be the best battle scene in a movie with a guest last week, the Rob Roy movie. And he shows up, I think, in your second book. And I was just like, oh, it's Rob Roy. Now we find out that he's not really... Another character doesn't find him to be as honest in his negotiations as he would like to be. So I'm just, and then with the different opinions on Prince Charles and all of those things, I can't keep my number straight. So you just pick one. there's several Charles there. How much do you let the character of your characters define their political opinions? And like, I would be very tempted to throw in some of mine. So do you, or the ever Julia's historical opinions?
It's impossible not to develop your own opinions of historical characters, because if you're researching them a lot, I mean, I haven't researched Rob Roy in enormous depth, I'll say that, because he's just a passing mention in the Chronicles, and then in Alex's story. Is mentioned as well, because he led the MacGregors to the 1715 rising. So he's mentioned in passing there as well, with opinions of him.
Right, right. But I was just using him as an example because
they were opinions. I mean, you know, because Walter Scott wrote Waverley and stuff, and he painted Rob Roy as a completely different sort of person to the one he was. You know, I mean, Walter Scott obviously founded historical fiction, so I love the guy. But he, you know, he didn't care if he wandered off and painted people in completely different lights. How they were.
And Rob Roy just say those... fiction. All you have to say is fiction.
But he was one of those people. Rob Roy was one of those people. There's a number of them in history that you either loved or you hated, depending on who you were. And, you know, some of the MacGregors would not have liked him very much because... He looks after himself. You know, he had his own agenda and he had a very complicated and fascinating life, but he wasn't necessarily a very nice person a lot of the time. So, you know, the opinions that... I don't really have an opinion of Rob Roy. I think he's very, very interesting. And I wouldn't like to meet him in a back alley in a bad temper, but I don't know... I haven't researched him enough to get a real feel.
Yeah. So you're saying that, you know, you're not definite on your opinion of Rob.
Not of him, but of other people. Yeah. Like, you know, like, I mean, Charles, for instance. So, you know, Prince Charles, I read masses of stuff about him to try, because he's the pivotal character in the whole thing. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not the major character in the series, but he's pivotal in the whole of historical stuff.
Well, that's right. Like, there's no major historical characters that are sort of like main characters in your book. They provide the history.
They're there, yeah. And I mean, Charles is probably the most main character of the real historical figures. But he was a fascinating person. And again, you know, if you're listening to the Jacobite view of him or the Hanoverian view of him, you get two completely different people. And the reality probably falls somewhere in the middle, but I've done a lot of research. And yeah, I formed opinions of him. I have. But I try not to put that into my characters, because my opinions are 21st century thoughts about him.
Right, right.
My characters lived in the 18th century. So I'm trying to do my opinions there based on...
They didn't have the internet.
Well, no, they didn't. But also, I mean, one of the major things I mentioned, I can't remember which book it is, but one of them, I talk about the difficulties Charles had afterwards of dealing with what had happened. And, I mean, if you're a modern person, that's PTSD.
No
such thing as post-traumatic stress disorder. It just didn't exist.
The entire, everyone had PTSD. Okay. There is no way emotionally to, I just had this discussion with someone a few weeks ago. I mean, we have battles with axes and children involved. Okay. Not a good thing. Not a good thing, Julia. No. I just walk out of the room at that time. So, and also they would need to have their heroes and their legends in order to survive the time, to keep fighting. So, but these people were real.
Yeah, and I mean, they had to deal with it. I mean, you know, my grandfather was in the First World War, and when the latest census records came out in 1921, were released in Britain. He's there. This is 3 years after the war had finished, and on the census is incapable of work due to neurasthenia, which is, you know, what they call shell shock, which is PTSD. Right. Now, this was a man who was the leader of a razor gang in Glasgow. He wasn't some shrinking violet. He was a man. He was destroyed by the war for years, and he was just left to get on with it. So, you know, Bonnie Prince Charlie, you know, did. I can't imagine what he must have gone through. So, yeah, to some extent, when I've written some of the scenes, they've been based on what I think he would have been going through. But they're not me imposing my
opinions, your thoughts.
And, you know,
no, but you are.
Hey, you've got post traumatic stress disorder cells.
Just like everybody did. No. But it is. But it's World War One was. I mean, they're all bad, but that one gets me. Okay, so do battles with children and axes. It's just not good. It's just part of the times. Yeah. The thing is that you, and I'm going to bring this up, I have to get to Brian's question, but I'm going to bring this up because I found with your characters themselves, you are very insightful into why people do what they do. And I find that with, like I said, I can just see you with your board saying, okay, this happened. I mean, it's an imaginary happening. You created the happening, but I can see this happening and this happening to cause this effect 25 years later. Or this is why he's acting the way he does, which is why I think you do these backstories so well. So I do think that your skill at doing that would lend to doing that with historical figures as well. We're not saying that you know all or whatever, but I think that you would probably have a good instinct as to who they were and what they're about. Brian, back to the technical side of being a writer. What sort of process do you use when writing the book and doing the various editing stages?
I use Word. Yeah. So I just use Word. I just write, word processor. I just write it.
And I know that you edit for other writers. No. Do you edit yourself or do you have only an editor come in?
I used to, only for one other writer now who's a friend of mine. I don't otherwise at all. No, I don't have time to do it. So I don't do it. I only do it for the one who's, and only because she's a friend. I wouldn't do it otherwise. The way I write basically is that I'll go upstairs and I'll sit and I'll write something. And then the next night I'll go back up and I'll reread what I wrote and I'll maybe amend it a bit and change it a bit. And it gets me into the period and the way of thinking to carry on. So then I'll carry on writing. When I finished a chapter, I'll stop and read the whole chapter and then I send it to a friend who reads it. I've got one person who reads it as I'm writing. And then I'll start the next one and so on and do the same thing. So, you know, I'm going over it, not deep editing, but I'm going over it and thinking, oh, God, you know, change that word and this and that and, oh, I don't want that and so on. And then when I finish the whole book, I go right back through it again in a lot more depth at that point. But it's all on Word. I do everything on Word. I don't have any of the programs that, you know, tell you your grammar and how to spell it. I wouldn't like that. I'm not interested.
So Julia, when she talks about the writing, she is a hardcore write author. And because not only is she an indie author, but she is one of those rare authors who is actually living on what she makes writing. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think I've met two or three of you this lifetime. So what do you attribute that to? Hard work, constant writing?
Very hard work. Because particularly, I mean, for me, because I've been told that I do it all wrong as an indie author as well, because it seems that independent authors are supposed to throw a book out every couple of months or something, or else everybody forgets who they are. And I couldn't write a book in 2 months. Not the way I do. I'm not saying people can't write a book in 2 months. That's a whole debate that's going on, and some people write great books. Being an independent author is very, very hard. I think being an author is very hard. It's not this great romantic, glamorous thing people think it is.
Just 1 second. She is living in a rural cabin in Scotland on her own. Writing. Yeah. You have the picture of the perfect. No, go ahead.
Yeah, but it's... I could do a whole series about independent writing, but you've got to be able to do everything yourself, or, you know, unless you've got loads of money, which I didn't have, you know, to do stuff. You have to write the books. You have to have the confidence to put your baby out there and watch everybody tear it apart. You have to look at your own covers, editing. Everything is down to you. So the decision-making process of things is all yours. You stand and fall by what you do, you know. Whereas if it goes to a publisher, you don't have any right. You lose your power over it. So the publisher decides on the editing. The publisher decides on the covers. They decide on when it's going to go out, how it's going to go out, any audiobooks and anything else. And that chunk is taken out of your hands. Whereas as an independent, you have to learn all of it, even if you're not going to do it yourself.
You still have to know how much it's going to cost and how, because we've discussed that indie is do-it-yourselfing or contracting. So you have to have a budget of what you can afford to know how much you can, like, for editing, for cover design, or you have to do it yourself.
Yeah, and do it yourself is, I mean, well, I think one of the mistakes that there's a few mistakes that independent authors make. And first of all, you've got to have a really good product. Secondly, you've got to remember that you are competing against all those top authors. If you put your book out on Amazon or on, you know, Barnes & Noble, whatever, you are in competition with all the other authors, including the ones that are massive publishing houses with loads of funds behind them. If you do your own cover and you're not a cover designer, it's going to look like a home published silly book, and people won't read it. It might be a brilliant novel, but they won't read it if it looks like an amateur.
No, the covers do matter. I realized one day, well, I was flipping through and I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm judging the book by the cover. I should not do that.
It's the shot window, and then you've got the blurb, and then you've got, you know, if I get the book on Kindle and I open it up and it's the fonts are all over the place because I've not formatted it properly. You know, and then you've also got the fact that you can write a great book with a great cover and brilliant blurb and stick it up there, and nobody's going to buy it because they don't know it's there. So then you've got to work out how you're going to market it as well. And, you know, there's there are people telling you how to do it, but that's the problem. You've got an awful lot of charlatans out there telling you how to write novels and how to publish them and what to do and offering to publish them for you. At great cost, which is really vanity publishing. It's not, you know, proper. There's a lot of people out there.
Oh, yeah. No. You have to be very careful. There are a lot of people trying to make money off of your inexperience with things that aren't going to work.
So you need to, even if you say, okay, I mean, I've got a cover artist. I'm useless at that. So I've got a wonderful cover artist. She's fantastic. But I have to tell her what I want. You know, if I just say, design me a cover for a book, she wasn't, no clue. She's not going to sit there and read my book because she's got a job. You know, she's designing covers. So I've got to tell her what I want. I've got to give her an idea of what I want. I've got to send stuff over. I've got to think. So I've got to have a good idea of what I want my cover to look like. And to do that, I've got to know all about historical book covers, what they look like. For that genre, there's no point in me doing a cover that's so different that nobody knows it's historical fiction looking at it. But on the other hand, I don't want to look exactly like everybody else's. So you've got to, even if you're not doing it yourself, you've got to still
know.
It's
a lot of work. It's like very, very one way lot. Or the other, you probably wake up in the morning and begin. And then you're doing something in that area, covers or something, till the end of the day, I would think.
Well, you've got to be disciplined as well. It's just you know, there's a lot more than just, you don't just write the book. There's a hell of a lot more to it than that. And you've got to be really, really dedicated. And you've got to allow for the fact that you could spend a year writing a book. So you're a year's work and earn nothing from it.
Yeah, no, you have to have faith. Okay, so you have to be disciplined. You have to be hardworking. You have to have the desire to learn.
Yep.
And you have to have faith because you're putting a lot of money, in some cases, a lot of time into something that you have absolutely no idea if it's going to work or not.
Yeah, and you've got to keep going. You know, if you write one book and publish it, you are not going to be a major author. I think it's unrealistic expectations.
I think it takes 3 books at least to get you moving. Yeah. That's the average I put, because then people trust you that you're a writer, especially with the series. I still get very disgruntled with people that write one that's a cliffhanger, and then you're waiting months and months and months and months and years and years, and they never do write a second one because they're still waiting to sell the first one. Like, you can't wait around to sell the first one. You got to start the second one right away, right?
I think it's unreal expectations. It's like, you know, if you look at any of the media stuff, if you look at acting, you know, there's a whole load of people out there that think, hey, you know, I'm going to be a famous actor. And they don't allow for the fact that there's only a few hundred famous actors in the world, and there's thousands and countless thousands that are not, you know, that maybe make a living, but yeah, they're not at the top. And it's the same, you know, the amount of people who've said to me, oh, you're J.K. Rowling, are you? You know,
I mean,
I doubt I'm going to make £1 billion at any point.
But you know? Can make a living is what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm making a living out, full living out.
Yeah. So, and that's it. There's only, I mean, how many authors can we say are really world famous out there? There's only so much room, and a lot of them, and that was luck. That was the movie guy picking up the book on his way out. It looked small, and there, you know, and then he read it and said, okay, this is good. And to do this with, it'll be easy, the kids will love it, and that boosted her. There's always some kind of magic or that just moment that, you know, helps you, like your meeting with Diana. It really, really helped you. So
yes, it so, has. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So as Julia says, not for the faint-hearted. It's like going into
you've got to know what you're going into. You've got to know that, you know, these people that are famous writers and famous musicians and famous actors didn't just go up and land that great contract. You know, they've probably worked for years behind it, and then suddenly something's happened that's pushed them. And it's the same with independent writing. You know, you can work years and get nowhere.
And then, you know,
might never get anywhere, or you might do it. But if you give up, you definitely won't get anywhere.
It's like, you know, people always say overnight success, and the person says, yeah, I've worked the last 20 years for this overnight. Yeah. Success. Okay, before we go to a serious question, I will just say my hubby just wrote in because he lives in dread of Jamie Fraser's. He hasn't met Alex yet. Next line. Going to be better than he could ever dream up, because it was written by a woman. And so he said, just put a muscled guy with a kilt and a big sword standing by a lock. That always sounds not in all houses, just maybe this one. Okay. So we have, did Julia have someone who really encouraged her to start writing, or how did she get started? And we're going to say the Noreen.
Noreen,
is that how you? Okay. Yeah. Is she had?
My mother. My mother used to write poetry. She taught me to read when I was a baby. Really, she had me bouncing on a knee to the alphabet and things like that. And by the time I was 3, I was reading. She used to read books to me. And then I used to read my own stuff, and she had endless patience. And in her view, reading was the key to absolutely everything, because if you can read, you can read anything, and you can learn
anything. And you can learn anything.
Yeah.
It's power.
So, you know, the first thing I did, I mean, was go to the, you know, I got a library ticket. As soon as I was five, I had a library ticket. But the problem was I was way ahead of my normal age, so I was reading older books. So my mum used to get books out for me on her library tickets because one book didn't last me any length of time, and I was reading junior level books. And then, you know, she used to write stuff, and she used to encourage me to write my own stories and things like that, and she used to praise them and she loved them. And when I said I wanted to be a writer, she never pushed me. She never said, right, you're going to be a writer, and so you've got to sit and write, you know, because that's how to make kids hate things. But she encouraged me. She always encouraged me.
By listening to your stories and
listening to my stories, talking about them, reading books together, talking about books in general. Yeah, you know, she always encouraged me all the way. And yeah, so my pen name, it's a pen name. Julia Brannan is a pen name, and Brannan was my mum's maiden name. So I took that name in honor of her, because she really, she made me recognize the absolute magic of books, that they take you into other worlds.
And that is important if you're going to be a writer, because the reading and the writing and the love of stories all comes together. Now I'm sitting here in dire curiosity, wondering what your real name is. Because I just can't help myself. Do you get out much? Are you still looking and visiting historic sites at this point in time to inspire your writing, or have you pretty much done those for this era?
No, I'm always going. I mean, there's always new things to find out anyway. So, I mean, when I start the next series, I'll be doing a lot more research, going off out different places. When I first started the Chronicles, I couldn't afford to go to all the different places, and I lived in Wales, so that was a very long way away as well.
Right.
Now it's great. Yeah, I mean, I live 2 hours from Culloden, so it's the 13th this year, because it's the weekend of the Battle of Culloden. They do a commemoration, and there, and people lay flowers, and loads of different people turn up, including chiefs of the clans and various different historians and so on. And then there's, you know, talks. And in the evening, there's a Cayley. That's great. So I'll be there. Yeah, I'll be there. I was there last year with a broken foot, which was interesting. But I'll be there. Yeah. And, you know,
it should be much more fun this year.
Yeah, it'll be more fun this year. But, you know, you learn new things as well, and you get to meet people who, you know, have got the same interests as you. And
which is
know
lovely.
A lot of
yes.
You don't know, because, you know, nobody can know anything. And it's just great exchanging ideas, and that can spark something. But yeah, I still will go and travel to places if I can do it, and I'm writing about somewhere, I will go and travel to it, because there's nothing like actually being there.
No, you feel we because thank you, Dave, that was my husband. We spend a lot when we're out, you know, other people want to go to the beach or whatever, we're going to a historical site or possibly a thrift store, which is also a historical site. Yeah. You never know where you're gonna find because that's what we just love to do. It's interesting, and you feel that history seep through you being on that location. You're like, oh my goodness, so many years ago this happened here.
Yeah, it gives you a really atmospheric feeling. I mean, I've got a friend who writes Anglo-Saxon books, and they're really, really good. And she also
want to share the name?
Yeah, her name's Annie Whitehead.
Okay, Annie.
And she writes non-fiction and fiction. But, you know, I think it was her son wrote about her and said, you can know my mum's a historical fictionist because she'll go and stand in the middle of a field and start crying. And
no, but it's true.
It's true. You do, you know. I mean, for her, even more so, because often she'll be standing in the middle of the field, there's nothing there, because it was so long ago. And for me, I'll go and stand by a few bits of crumbling wall, and I'm like, oh my God, this is where this happened. You know, and it's, yeah, you can look at the scenery around it. It's, I don't know, there's just something really magical.
See,
where
there, yeah, no, it is. It is. It is like going back in time, but only through your feelings and emotions and imagination. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We don't. So, no, I was going to say, and that, when you bring that up, when we talk about two different stories at the same time from the same era. I remember we would watch The Last Kingdom and a show that we have on the History Channel called Vikings at the same time. And we became comparing characters and like, oh, he's being him and he's being there. So no, you cannot get enough of certain eras. They just... You see different portrayals of characters and that's the way it is. So thinking about different eras and things, you have a new series coming up. Is that going to be through the same time or something completely different?
It's not completely different. I'm finishing Antony 2 because Antony's story became so big that I realized it'd have to be two books. So I'm on the second book now. When I finish that, I'm going to decide to go right back to the start of the whole Jacobite thing because the 45 was the end.
Yeah, yeah.
And the beginning goes back to the
68. There were three risings, right?
Oh, there were three that you know about, yeah, but there were a lot. There were more than little ones going along all the time, you know. But the three major ones were 1689, and the years directly following that, which included things like the Battle of the Boyne and so on, 1715 and 1745. They're the ones that people probably know a bit.
So you're
about.
Going back to 1715?
No,
or
I'm going
earlier that.
I'm going back to the 1680s.
Okay.
The whole thing started when, you know, King James the Seventh and Second was taken off the throne, if you like.
Right. So that will, that will be really interesting because that will be, I like that.
But it'll also have some of the
characters. Do that, Julia.
Yeah, but it'll also have some of the characters from the Chronicles. It's going to have Yellowsack, Dewey's best grandmother, there with the MacDonalds of Glencoe. And at some point, eventually, you know, it'll start to move forward and you'll have like Graham, who's a character, a gardener.
So I'm mashing.
It will, yeah. I mean, in one sense, it'll be a prequel to the Jacobite Chronicles because it'll lead up to the start of, you know, the Jacobite Chronicles. I'm in the process of sort of doing research and planning and getting some ideas together for it. But yeah, I don't know how many books it's going to be. I have no idea at the moment, but that's what I want to do is go backwards and deal with that because it's a bit, in a way, you know, I wrote about the end of the thing before the beginning, which is a bit strange.
It doesn't matter where you start. If you start at the end and end at the start, it's okay. I feel like a Dr. Seuss book is coming on here. Julia, start at the end at the start. Doesn't matter. Just play your part.
Yeah, I think people will read it. If they've read my other stuff and they love what I write, then they'll read that as well. But, you know, it's a fascinating period of history and not many people have written about it.
And then, I'm fascinated when I get there. Okay, Brian, author Brian Greiner, but he won't put that on there, so I can't do anything about that. Julia, does writing historical fiction help you connect with your personal and national history at a deepest level? At a deeper level. Well, first of all, she's English.
I was born in England, but I was born and brought up as a Scot because my mum was going to come to Scotland to have me because she wanted me to be a Scot. She was a Scot. So when she was too ill to travel up, so I was born in England in the end, she just ignored that and brought me up as a Scot. So I actually, I've always thought of myself as a Scot. And when I did my... DNA, you know, with ancestry, you know, this DNA and
yes,
blah blah. To my absolute surprise, I have no English DNA. No
English DNA. So
it's all Scots, Welsh, Irish, and Scandinavian. There's no English.
Oh my goodness, that's what they just sailed around the North Sea having fun. This is my theory.
Yeah, having babies, yeah, and. So, yeah, I mean, I'm English by accent and by birth, but not at all in the way I think this is my home. Scotland is my home. I feel at home here in a way that I've never quite felt anywhere else. And, I mean, don't get me wrong, living in England was great. Living in Wales was wonderful, but I feel at home here. But, yeah, it's on a personal, on a national level, yes, it makes you feel deeper, more deeply involved. And on a personal level... I've got to admit, I mean, my clan is the Gordoners and I don't know that much. And I live in the middle of Gordon country as well. And I don't know anything like as much about them as I do about the McGregors. all the McDonald's of Glencoe, which is a bit shameful, really, isn't it? I'll probably learn more about them in the next to write the next series.
So yes, it has brought her closer to your personal history and Scotland in general, right?
Yeah.
Dave, husband again. I was going to say she's part Viking. Don't you say anything about people being part Viking. Thank you very much. Okay. See how to deal with me there. So why does this time go so fast? So why do you live so far away, Julia? We can't have tea. I wanted to say, okay, let's get this in order. So the first time I read Anthony, I thought, oh, you don't have to, you can just read this because it picked up so lovely as a separate story. But as I said before, now I'm thinking, no. In what order would you suggest your books? Should you do all the chronicles before hitting the stories? Or could you read Alex first?
Okay. No, I would say read the Chronicles first, but you have to read those in order. So you have to read book one to book six because it's an ongoing story. So if you started in the middle, you wouldn't know what was going on, basically. You do need to. I mean, I do the story so far, but it's a paragraph.
So do you do that throughout the entire series?
The series of six.
You do the story so far. But there's so much detail and you really, really want to read it. Okay, I'm going to talk fast. Almost as fast as Julia.
The backstories, no, you can read them out of order, but you should really read Harriet's book before Caroline and Philippa's because Harriet's book carries on through Caroline and Philippa and then Alex before Anthony.
Well, and don't read Anthony till you're on the second book or something of the series, second or third book of the Chronicles.
Yeah, and then there's another book, there's a novella as well called Dealing in Treason, which fills in a gap in Mask of Duplicity.
Is best to just read the Chronicles, then read Harriet before
Caroline and Philippa.
And then Alex. Okay, I'm going to bring up your blog again. It's absolutely perfect. It has all the references of where you found the books. It has blogs that concern the stories that you've written and things that will be interest because you've read that book and you might be more curious about it. So a lot of your research goes into your blogs as well.
Yeah.
And so this is a new series coming. Where can people get your books?
Okay, so the first Mask of Duplicity and Dealing in Treason you can get at any ebook provider. The others at the moment are all in Kindle Unlimited. So if you've got Kindle Unlimited, you can read them for free. And they're on Amazon. The paperbacks... again, this is one of the things about being self-published. My paperbacks are not automatically in bookstores and so on because I'm not traditionally published. So you can buy the paperbacks on Amazon or you can go to your bookstore or your library and request that they order them, which they can do. There's also an audiobook. So there's Audible, iBooks or whatever it's called, Apple Books and Amazon. They're in audio as well.
So they're out there. The ebooks are really affordable. You're saying $4.99 American, right?
Yeah.
They're Julia is just all around a great read. And once again, these are not romance books, regardless. I mean, there are some steamy scenes, but there are some steamy scenes in life. So they are basically about the life and more so as they go on. Okay, was there anything that we missed that they need to know, Julia?
I don't know. I've got okay, so if you've read some of the books and you like them, there's the Jacobite Chronicles reader group on Facebook, which you're welcome to join, that I'm very active in. The website has got most of the most information on about my books, where to get them, links to get them, audiobook samples, links to everything. And that's www.juliabrannon.com.
It's been running along the bottom if you're on something visual. And just remember, Julia Brannon is not her real name. I've yet to find that out.
And I've also got a newsletter that I put out every month. I don't send loads of spam and rubbish like that. I hate it. So I just put one newsletter out every month, and that's got what I've been doing in the month, any book news, and usually a couple of little blogs about something that don't show up anywhere else. So if you like my work or you like the historical period, you can join my newsletter if you want. And the links to that, to join that, are again on the website.
Okay, great. Another hour gone out of our lives. You really must come back and visit again. And we'll do this all over. And anytime. Just like this time. Vicky, you said come back. I'm like, yes. Julia, fantastic.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much. People listening to it enjoyed it.
I'm sure they did. We have people from last time back, so you know. So they obviously enjoyed it last time, and it's pretty much the same. Okay, you take care. And
thank you very much. Have a lovely time. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, and have a lovely time in your cottage, running away. Bye-bye. I have to remove. There we go. Always lovely to visit with Julia. I will see all of you next week. Until then, may your coffee be hot and your stories sweet. Thank you for listening, everyone.